Sharon Lifshitz is the daughter of 85-year-old Yocheved and 83-year-old Odette. Her elderly parents lived on kibbutz near Oz and were taken hostage by Hamas on October 7th. Mercifully, her mother was released on Monday, October 23rd, 2023, following 17 days in captivity in an underground Hamas dungeon. Her husband, Sharon's father, remains in Gaza, his health and status unknown. Sharon lives with her family in London, England, but has been spending most of her time in Israel since October 7th, supporting her mother and actively engaged in working with the Hostage Family Forum to raise awareness of this ongoing horror. We talk about that horrible day when everything stopped, how exhausted they are after more than 6 months of this surreal, knife-edge existence, and her bewilderment by how harshly and quickly the world has turned on Israel and Jews. Speaking of this never-ending hell and the onset of Passover, Sharon says, "We face the abyss and we stand tall." And she adds, "I don't know how I will sit the Passover table this year." But she will, and we talk about where and how that will be. Listen to her carefully. Think of her father, Oded, in captivity, and the other 132 hostages. And please have a look at the short written Passover message that we will publish on Monday on the stateoftelaviv.com website. We include a short prayer to be read with a fifth cup of wine to honor and remember the 133 innocents still in Hamas captivity, waiting to be liberated. Remember them and their families. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the beautiful but suitably subdued state of Tel Aviv. Stay with us. Sharon Lifshitz, good morning on this quite beautiful Friday morning in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for making time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't we begin with your October 7th story? Where were you?
I got up really early with my son and my husband, and we traveled up north to pick a puppy.
Where were you? Where do you live?
We live in London, in the UK. My son is 12. And he'd been wanting a puppy for a very long time. And finally, the big day has arrived. And as we were traveling up north, I opened the news and saw that something is going on. I then call, as I do, I did the usual ritual. I call my mother, and she didn't answer. I called my father. He didn't answer. Then I called my oldest brother, Arnon. And Arnon's voice, just his voice, made me feel that something really different has happened. And he said that, yes, there's been a very hard shelling and there's a terrorist that entered Israel. And he said that we had been in touch with mom and dad, but we lost touch with them now.
And your mom and dad were living
in the kibbutz. So my mom and dad live in kibbutz near Oz, which is very close to the border with Gaza. They lived there for 65 years. And so that's then how the day unfolded, just watching news. And about 2 hours later, it really sunk in because I saw Al Jazeera video that showed one of the Al Jazeera so-called journalists standing very clearly behind my parents' house and saying that they have occupied the Zionist settlement called Kibbutz Nir Oz, and that behind him there were gunmen on motorcycles and so on and so forth. And that sight just made, it was our worst nightmare unfolding on live
TV. It must have just been horrifying to see them outside your parents' home.
It wasn't my parents' home. It was just like 110 meters from it. But we know the place so well, you recognize every bit of it instantly. And so you know the proximity. And so it's gone on since from that. By the evening, we knew they were missing, but it took a long time. And it was very anxious and being away and just trying to understand what's happening on the WhatsApp groups in the kibbutz, because I'm not part of them. And just being constantly on news channels. And it was the day the world fell apart for us.
It certainly fell apart for you, and it fell apart for many of us, just not perhaps quite as directly impactful and immediate in that way. Near Oz, you grew up on the kibbutz?
Yes, I grew up in the kibbutz.
And your brother Arnon as well?
I have three brothers. I'm the third, so my oldest brother, his name is Arnon, he's 10 years older than I. My second brother is Ar, he's 7 years older than I. And my little brother, Omri, is 2 years younger than me.
Did any of them stay on the kibbutz?
No, none of them have stayed, but Arnon brought up his oldest child on the kibbutz, Daniel, and his ex-wife stayed, and Arnon himself lived very close by to my parents.
So you're sitting, yes, are you still driving to get the puppy? Do you end up getting the puppy that day?
No, we arrive in York and then we don't, because we have no clue what's happening.
So you turn around and go back home and are basically glued that day to the television, whatever sources of information you can find, stumbling through the same fog that we all were. At what point did you realize that your parents had been taken hostage by Hamas? And your parents are, just state their names and their ages for
my mom
people.
Is Yocheved Lifshitz, and she's 85. And my dad is Oded Lifshitz, and he's 83. Soon he will be 84.
You have elderly parents living on the kibbutz. At what point do you learn with some degree of certainty that they have been taken?
I think by the end of the day. So kibbutz Nir Oz was totally abandoned. No army or police were there on the day. Our defense unit, which is six people, fought really bravely, but there were hundreds of Hamas terrorists, and they were followed by hundreds and hundreds of civilians. And so we lost most of our security unit very early on. They were injured or they were killed. And then individuals tried to fend for their families. And there was no bullets were shot by Israeli defense forces on that day. They arrived at about 1:30 or 2. And then by then, all the terrorists and the civilians from Gaza already left the place. And then they were collected to one safe area. And from there, they walked between the houses to find who is alive. Of course, they saw many bodies, and we had more than 40 people that were killed on that day, and many people were missing. So 77 people were taken hostage. We lost about, I think, 11 or 14 Thai workers that were wonderful people and worked in the kibbutz, and they were shot all together in one room. And my parents were not meant to be on the kibbutz. They rented a car from the kibbutz, so the kibbutz thought they were not there. My father didn't feel well the night before, and so they were at friends, and my brother took him back to the kibbutz. They arrived really late, but without the car. Nobody thought my father was in the kibbutz, and my mom. And so they only went to look in the house much later on. But even then, news was really broken. We did not know that the house was totally burnt down for quite a while, for a day or so. But that's when we really realized that my parents were gone. And really, until my mom came back, which is 2 days before, Hamas released a tweet or something saying that they tried to release my mom and Nurit Cooper, and that Israel refused to take them back. And that was the first we heard that my mom was alive. We had no clue. We had no clue about my mom. We had no clue about my dad. And the whole house burned down. So we didn't know if they were injured or not because it was in ashes, everything. There was no signs we could take out of the place. And so when Hamas released the text, it became clear that my mom is probably alive. We thought they were together. And then 2 days later, she was released.
And what was the date, I mean, of her release?
23rd of October.
So on the 21st, Hamas issued some sort of text or statement on Telegram or?
I can't remember.
Okay. I wasn't aware of that. And they said, we want to release these two elderly women, but Israel won't accept them.
Yeah.
Do you know anything around that particular statement?
I think that it might have been true in the sense that Israel was trying to work towards the release of everybody or a big group of the civilian hostages.
Right.
And so they might have said no. And then Hamas insisted. We know in retrospect that I've been told that before big hostage exchanges, they often try to prove they can return the people. So it's quite normal to have a small return. There were the two American ladies that were released a few days earlier, and then my mom and Nurit were released without a deal.
When Yocheved Lifshitz and Nurit Cooper, age 79 and also from kibbutz near Oz, were released late at night on Monday, October 23rd, Yocheved, at the moment she was handed from Hamas control to the Red Cross, turned to one of the masked terrorists who had escorted her. She took his hand and said, Shalom. Her gesture surprised many, myself included. I asked Sharon to explain what had happened. She talks about the shock. Her mother had endured 17 days of extreme trauma and physical hardship. She was physically unwell. No one told her that she was being released. She and Nurit Cooper were led on an arduous underground trek of several kilometers through the web of underground tunnels. In fact, Yocheved had likened them to a spider web. They had to climb 40 meters, it's approximately 120 feet, to reach ground level on very unstable ladders in darkness. And then she emerged into a chaotic scene with people yelling. Throughout the impossible journey, the man to whom she turned to say Shalom had been kind and helped her. She turned to thank him. Sharon explains the experience of her mother from the moment of her violent capture to her release.
I think my mom lived in that part of the world. There's many people, there's many Israelis that are Arab or Bedouins. They are our neighbors in Gaza that she lived next to for 65 years. It's not unknown to her. They sat in a house, she sat in their house. And so she was able to distinguish between the absolutely horrific acts committed. And let's understand, she didn't see everything. She was taken at 8:30 in the morning through the fields. And when she was taken through the fields, hundreds of Shabab, of civilians, were running towards her with sticks and guns and hitting her and hitting. She's 85-year-old woman.
Yeah.
Lying on a motorcycle, being taken through the field, lying like a carpet, a rolled carpet on a motorcycle. 85-year-old wrapped up in a rug or something they took from the house. And so she have seen that. She have seen those people. But then she was in total isolation underground, and the people that were looking after them in the underground, she felt grateful. They looked after the people that were injured. At that point, she left after 17 days, yeah? And the people that were there were disciplined, were treating them, they were not harming them purposefully. They changed the dressing of her friend that was injured. And so she was making a distinction between different people. And the person that she shook his hand, he was a paramedic, and he treated her in a humane way, and they had a conversation of sort, and she saw him without the costume, and you know, it was spur of the moment. It's a 85-year-old woman that just walked for several kilometers, not having a clue what's happening.
Wow, they made her walk to the release?
So she was in a room, and then they had this huge, long walk in the tunnel, several kilometers in the darkness. And then they had to climb 40 meters worth of ladders and stairs and very precarious construction. 85-year-old woman.
How did she do that?
The body in distress is able to do things that you can't imagine. At the end of that day, she's taken through the crowd, which she's most afraid of because of the kind of being attacked by the mob. And then she's another car and somebody's talking kindly to her. She's not aware of world media.
Yeah, yeah.
She's not aware of everything. She has just been for 17 days, she's been totally ill. That's why they released her, because she was very unwell. And so all of this happened. She thinks my dad is dead. She just left other people she knew all her life in the tunnel. She has no clue. She has no map. She has no guidance of what is happening. So think about your mom or somebody like that is in that situation. She kept her cool. She kept her cool.
Unbelievable.
She wanted to really remember all the details of what is happening. And when she met somebody that was talking to her kindly, she turned to him and shook his hand.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special, a 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
When she was in captivity in Gaza, was she held with your father?
No.
So they were separated. What happened?
My father was holding the door to the safe room. My mom was in bed still. And my father was talking shortly before that to a friend of his, and told him he can hear Arabic spoken outside. He held the door. The bullets went through the door. One of the bullets hit him in the lower arm. He felt not well. He was hit by them and then dragged outside and put outside the house.
Your father?
Yeah, with an injury, blood pressure problems. And then my mom was taken out. Six guys were in the room. Two of them tried to hit her as well. There was an older man that protected her. He's the one that wrapped a rug around her because she was in her 90, barefoot, no glasses, no hearing aid, just in her pajamas. And then she's taken outside very quickly. We live next to the fence. And she sees my father lying on the floor unconscious. And that's the last she saw of him after 63 years of marriage. And then she's taken on the motorcycle very quickly, because at that point they don't think they have time. So they're trying to just take as many hostages as quickly. She's taken by Hamas terrorist. And very quickly after that, she's put into a car. And from the car, she's in the tunnels and she's walking with a few other kibbutz members.
So the car goes down. That's one of the cars that goes into the tunnel?
No, I think there was a kind of shaft where they entered. So she's dropped there and then she started the journey. But it's a long journey. She walks several kilometers.
Was it your mom who likened the journey to being part of a spider web?
Yes, my mom called it a spider web.
It was a very powerful metaphor, because immediately you understand when she said that. So the last time she's seen your father, he was injured, lying on the ground. Have there been any confirmed sightings of your father since?
Yeah. So when my mom came back, she basically told us that dad is dead. He's gone. I saw him. When the hostages came in the exchange, one of them told us that he was with her in the room. We heard it from someone else that said that another hostage told them she was with my father in the same room. The first period, another hostage then saw him on the first day in El Nassar Hospital. He was given basic treatment. He was taken away to have his wound dressed and then possibly was taken. He was not very well. He was with this other kibbutz member. We don't know the exact amount of days. And at the end of this time, he didn't feel well and was taken away. And so we don't, in effect, have much news for him, any news for the last 165 days or so.
Following Yocheved's release, we learned a little more about the conditions of the hostages' captivity. Yocheved was held in a small underground room with bars. Most of the 12 or so people contained there in the days immediately following October 7 were elderly members of kibbutz near Oz. There was also a mother with her 6-year-old daughter. One or two days into their captivity, Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar paid the group a visit. Sharon tells us about that encounter. There were early reports of a group of elderly people, and I believe there was a mother with a young daughter. But mostly elderly people, mostly from near Oz, who were held together in a room in the tunnels. And at one point, I believe it was on the second day after they had been taken, Yahya Sinwar came down to speak with them. Can you tell us what your mom's told you, what you know of that encounter?
My mom said that Sinwar came and stood at the entrance to the room, and he told them they have nothing to worry, they would not get harmed, and in a few days there will be a deal and they will all go back home. And she asked him, why did he do it to them that worked all their life for peace? And he didn't answer. I think that...
What did he do? Did he just walk away?
I don't know. But he did not answer. It doesn't, I don't think that for Hamas there's a distinction between different people. They were happy to kill 30 Bedouins. They were happy to kill any nationality. They did not make a distinction even between Muslims and Jews, let alone between left-wing Jews and right-wing Jews, or however you divide us. But I think that he really is a person that believes in creating total chaos as a way of liberating Palestine.
Absolutely. And he did a very good job of it. I have to hand it to him. That was quite brilliantly planned and executed operation, even more so because our army completely disappeared on us. Your mom and dad are peace activists, and they have been working all their lives to achieve some kind of negotiated settlement, peace, two-state, however it would be sorted out. What I'm interested in knowing is, has she changed her views at all? So when she asked, for example, Sinwar, why are you doing this to us? Does she still feel that peace is something that can be achieved in the way she did before October 7th? Or does she see that maybe that is a futile aspiration?
I don't think my mom changed her outlook on life. She came back very much herself, very much. I don't feel she's broken. It's been really tough. It's getting progressively tougher. And we are so exhausted. But I believe from what I hear from her that she doesn't see another alternative to us being able to live here and raise our children and grandchildren without reaching term agreements with our neighbors. I don't think you can do much with Hamas, but I think that there are moderate parties that we should strengthen and we should work with them. For my mom and my dad, for which I cannot speak for my dad because he's not here. But from everything I understood from him, he believed that there is a capacity to reach long-term agreement with our neighbors, and that if we don't do that, it will become progressively harder to live here. Did he believe something like 7th of October will happen? Absolutely not. I can tell you that categorically. He did not. We did not have a conversation. But we did have conversations often about how terrible the situation in Gaza is and how difficult it is for the people of Gaza. And my father saw all along Hamas for what it is, a terrorist totalitarian organization that when it came in democratically crushed its opposition, threw PLO people out of the roofs after shooting them.
Right.
And this was, some of them were his friends, long-term friends with which he worked for many years. So I think he would, I believe my mom said it is what happens when you don't make agreements. And I think that my father always thought that peace is a tough thing to do and you have to compromise and you have to give up on things, but that it's worth it because you avoid war.
I think that all of that is understandable intellectually. What I certainly struggle with now, I don't know about you, is reconciling that kind of statement, point of view, with the brutality that we've seen and that is still ongoing. And if there are moderates, I wish they'd speak up.
Me too. But yeah. I also think that it is a totalitarian regime. But I do believe it's possible. In fact, I believe that there is a very big opportunity here that we are missing to reach long-term agreement. I don't talk about peace at the moment because I feel that so many of us don't have peace in our hearts anyway.
Right.
But we are ready to, we lost so much. And in order to avoid further losses for both sides, we need to grow up, have leaders that tell us the truth, that speak to us about the necessary compromises we need to make in order to make this place able to accommodate two nations living side by side. I think that it should lead eventually to a two-state solution. It's the only solution my parents ever believed is possible, is right, is fair.
In the final moments we have, Sharon, I want to focus on the upcoming holiday, which is not going to be much of a holiday this year. We're speaking on Friday. Jewish families in Israel and all over the world will be marking Passover next week. And we're meant to celebrate, of course, freedom. And it's going to be a very, very, very difficult Passover this year, given what has gone on and what continues. What are your thoughts about this moment, and I say this moment quite broadly, what's gone on in the context of our historical memory and reality?
I think we are in a moment that we will talk about for hundreds of years to come. I think we are in a moment that I personally am driven by, first of all, above all, my contract with my father as a daughter, and it breaks my heart continuously to know that he's there, maybe he's alive. It's very possible that he isn't by now. But then, you know, not to know what happened to him and how it happened to him, not to be there for him. He's a very generous and kind man and always helped many people. I think that this Passover for me is an impossibility, and I'm hanging somewhere between my son, who is 12, who is looking at us, thinking, what is happening in the world? Am I safe? And having to give him, and I think that's something that have been, I wanted from the beginning for him to see that even when everything crashed down to the ground, we stand strong, we stand tall, we speak truth to power, we try to do with our very moderate means whatever we can. And I've met so many other families who are acting so gracefully in facing the most impossible thing. The family of the hostages, but the families who lost loved ones, my friend who lost her daughter, who is like a daughter to me, I feel I lost her daughter. And we have to work towards a better world. We have to put our energies into it. This is not decent. And I think that I don't know how to sit at the Passover table. I don't know how to do anything. Myself, my family have chose to do the Passover with the kibbutz. So there is a seder of the kibbutz and we will join other families. I'm handing over that moment to the care and love of other kibbutz members. And I know that it will be good to be together with them. I have no answer. There is no story in there that I can relate to in terms of liberation, because we haven't seen them liberated. And they are there. They are really suffering. Many of them are no longer alive. Many of them lived for many days. Sometimes I think of my father almost as an enigma by now, 6.5 months that he has been away from us, from his home, from his habits, from his friends. What kind of life does he have now? How does he live day by day? And so we face the obese and we stand tall.
How is your mom holding up? It's hard to even ask that question.
So many people are so deeply traumatized by the events of the 7th of October. She loves her community and she also feels overwhelmed by the level of grief and suffering. And we are just at the beginning of this story.
I agree.
But my mom is 85. She's living one day at a time. She lives her life. She looks after the family. She brings us together endlessly. And she's a ray of light. She is loved by so many people. She doesn't even understand the scale of the love that there is toward her. And I think it gives us her also energy. And she's waiting for my dad.
Is her health improved since she was released?
Yes, she's 86, yeah. Almost 85. It's not easy.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
The stress over time take its own toll.
I just want to ask you how you personally place in context the enormity of what happened on October 7th and continues every day since, with the hostility that has just surged with respect to Jewish people in Israel around the world. I'm from Toronto. I happened to be in Toronto at the time. And on October 7th in the evening, because of the 7-hour time difference, there were celebrations in the streets. We have a very large Muslim community there. Celebrations. This was before Israel went in on the ground. This was in the moment. People were celebrating. And I know you live in London and there were similar celebrations there and in many cities in the world. How do you square that with the barbarism and the savagery of what Hamas did?
In some ways, because I am the hostage families, I have had to put a lot of things to one side and concentrate. It's very hard sometimes to get up in the morning and in front of me is our people in Gaza. And so I put to one side everything. As a person, an Israeli and a Jewish Israeli that has lived in London most of her life, I'm very concerned by it. I find it that what caused the 7th of October is above all hate, unmediated hate, the possibility of seeing the other as not even human. And I hate hate. I find it really, it's death. Hate is death to your own soul, to everything. And so I try with my meager powers to fight in a way hate. And I see a lot of people from my sphere, from arts and from filmmaking and academia, coming out with very clear views of good and bad and casting us as the ultimate bad. And I find that it's sad. I find that it's limiting. I find that the story is complicated.
Something very profound has shifted in Sharon's life.
the Passover story, where we feel the weight and burden of the past, where the strong, proud, independent Israeli is reacquainted with the stereotypical helplessness of the diaspora Jew. From the earliest moments, October 7th has been analogized to the Shoah, the Holocaust, in terms of savagery, barbarism, sadism, incomprehensible torture, mutilation, murder, burning whole families alive while they are bound, mothers stifling the cries of infants with their hands over their mouths, families hiding in closets and attics. It is as if pure hell descended on southern Israel and evil marauded and terrorized, encountering almost no resistance, as if the years-long Holocaust was distilled into 36 hours.
I came to London as an Israeli, not as a Jew. It took me 10 years to see that something is happening at all. I came from Israel. Other people came from Spain and from Germany. I did not have that feeling that Jews that grew up in the UK or other parts have. I just grew up in my own country. And so I always have a bit of a different sensitivity towards it. I see around me so many people, so many Jewish people and Israeli people that has absolutely nothing to do with the story. They are not soldiers. They're just people living in the UK. And they shrink. They are shrinking in their own life. They're trying to avoid so many situations. They're trying to avoid confrontations. That's really sad for me. I think at the heart of it also is the fact that somehow Hamas is missing from the conversation. And it's a little bit like describing how the US and the UK enter Afghanistan without talking about Al-Qaeda. Then none of it is making sense. I personally feel that there were other options Israel could have taken, and I don't feel that Israel took the course of action I would have liked them to take at all. And I think that we paid for it with the life of many hostages and many innocent civilians. I think that many of those innocent civilians also descended on my kibbutz and murdered people with sticks and knives and looted and did horrendous things and took children as hostages. So the distinction is not so clear to me about civilians in Gaza overall. I know there's many innocent people there and I lament very much their life. I also lament the fact that people become so toxic in their life. And I think that at the end of it, you have moderate people that value life above all, and you have people that are, you can call them extremists, but people who value land above life. And I think that on both sides, I feel an affinity with people that value life above land. And if you think about the space, there's a space for both of us to live if we value life.
Thank you for your candor, your thoughtfulness. I hope that soon your family and all of the families have an answer.
Thank you very much.
Some clarity. Thank you. Thank you so much, Sharon. This evening, Sharon Lifshitz will join her mother, Yocheved, other family members, and the Nir Oz community for the Passover Seder. Remember them. Her father, Oded Lifshitz, in Hamas captivity now for 198 days. Perhaps alive, perhaps, as Sharon acknowledges, not. And remember the other 132 souls suffering in the most brutal circumstances. Young women, elderly men, children. In every generation, we must feel the pain and exhilaration of the liberation of the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt. This is why we gather at the Seder table. May you have a meaningful holiday. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming,
as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the state of Tel Aviv.